This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Earth Matters. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The number of tigers in the wild continue to drop despite the best efforts of conservationists. Not in the business of giving up hope, though, the Worldwide Fund for Nature Malaysia are keeping up the fight to protect and save the Malayan tigers from extinction, but they need our help to do so. They are organizing the inaugural Panda Ball Charity Dinner on 13th June 2015, and I find out more about the ball and WWF Malaysia's efforts at tiger conservation from Datuk Dr. Dino Sharma, the Executive Director and Chief Executive Officer of WWF Malaysia. Dr. Dino, it's been a while. How are things at WWF Malaysia going?
Good. I think we've been really challenged to try and find the resources to do our conservation work. There's a lot of it cut out for us. And we have great plans to do a whole range of things to save the various species and spaces in the country. And we continue to try and hire talent to do the work we need to do.
There used to be 9 tiger subspecies worldwide, but in the last 70 years, 3 of them have gone extinct, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Really, it has been the issue of habitat loss and poaching, habitat reduction, habitat fragmentation that has caused tigers to go extinct in some places. So we have lost, for example, the Caspian tiger, the Balinese tiger, the Javanese tiger. And really what we have now is the Malayan tiger, the Bengal tiger, the Amur, the Siberian tiger, and the Indochinese tiger. And of course, across the Straits of Malacca, the Sumatran tiger. So those are the few subspecies that are left, 3 gone and gone forever.
What are the ramifications for the species of these subspecies going extinct?
So when a subspecies of an animal goes extinct, really a subspecies of an animal is an animal carrying certain genetic material not found in its fellow subspecies. So when one subspecies goes extinct, it simply suggests that that genetic material is gone and gone forever and cannot be brought back. So ensuring that the remaining 5 subspecies of tigers and that genetic material continues to survive well into the future is really top priority for all of us.
According to TRAFIC, the Wildlife Trading Monitoring Network, there are about 2,500 wild tigers left. Where are they to be found?
A few years ago, in 2010, there was a global estimate made, and it was believed that there were 3,200 tigers left in the wild. And of course, that's a compilation of all the population data we have across the 13 countries where tigers exist. But we in Malaysia had a guesstimate, if you like, almost in the 1950s, that there were about 3,000 in the peninsula itself. Tigers don't occur in Borneo. And in the year 2003, there was an estimate made by the Wildlife Department that informed us that there were about 500 tigers down from the 3,000 of the 1950s. But really, the horror of it all is that last year, three tiger biologists came together and crunched some recent data, and that now informs us that we have as low as 250 tigers left in Malaysia.
Which is really not many at all. I mean, that's almost...
That's not many at all. I struggle to imagine how you can really walk into a forest and still find a tiger, if you like. Imagine 250 spread across the forest of the peninsula. They're probably very sparse and not found everywhere. So there are a few places where tigers are found and they have been studied in the country. And I think really the challenge then is to go out and try to do all the right things to ensure that they are protected as opposed to even further eroding to extinction.
So when we say that we are trying to find out these numbers, what's the process of trying to estimate or guesstimate, how many are left?
Yeah, so in the past, there were ways to try to enumerate them, and people generally went out and did what we call park mark census. So when a tiger walks in a habitat, a sandbank of a river or a muddy spot or whatever, because of their weight, they leave marks behind, and there are ways to trace that marking left by the footprints. And then measure them, and you can identify male and female and so on and so forth. And by doing an assessment of pug marks left behind, one could then try to make a guesstimate or an estimate of tigers. Very imperfect science. Nowadays, we've almost really done away with that old methodology. With the advent of camera traps, these are really hit-in-motion sensor cameras, where any tiger passing by the sensor gets picked up, gets photographed really, and the unique stripe pattern of each individual is really the signature, the thumbprint of the animal. Then sort of taking all that picture data into a software program, one can actually analyze, run a statistical program and analyze and generate an estimate of the density of tigers. How many tigers can be found per square kilometer of forest, if you like, you know?
And in Malaysia, 250 is... That's such a sad number. So the Malayan tiger is the ninth subspecies of tiger. It was considered a separate and distinct subspecies in 2004, which is relatively recent. What can you tell me about the Malayan tiger in particular in terms of, you know, what makes it unique, its ecology, habitat, distribution?
Yes. So when we look at all the remaining subspecies of tigers, you have the Siberian tiger that often you see photographs of them trampling in snow. And then you hear of the Bengal tiger. Often you see pictures of them wandering in the mangrove swamps in the Sundarbans. But the Malayan tiger is a forest dweller. So it lives in thick, dense jungles. And therefore, it's adapted to living in a jungle, which means it's got to be a predator looking for food, often of which they don't see the predator. Predators themselves are hiding in the forests. So they have evolved in time to live in a tropical rainforest and have actually evolved a predator-prey strategy. So these top-notch predators, they're able to, in a very stealth way, sort of find their prey, feed themselves, and of course hide their cubs away from other predators, for example. But what makes them unique is that at the genetic level, once you go all the way up north, right to the border of the Thai-Malaysian border, and you go to the Thai-Malayan Peninsula, you find no tigers there. And that becomes really the northernmost limit of that particular genetic material. So it's really an effect of being isolated over time and that particular genetic material sort of mixing in that population left that has now made that subspecies unique to the peninsula of Malaysia.
And you mentioned that right now, you know, what's important is kind of going out there and doing what we need to do, doing the correct things for our tigers. And so is it correct then to say that tiger numbers, you know, if you want to kind of halt that decline or even reverse it, we need to look at loss of habitat and poaching? Are those sort of the most immediate threats?
Yes. So in fact, if we look at land use data and maps over the decades, we find that, we have actually converted a lot of forests for agriculture land, human needs, development and things like that. And that's a given. I mean, every country develops its land and uses its natural resources for profit and well-being of humanity. But that has had a dramatic impact on animals like tigers because they need large spaces. They need their habitats to be connected. So what we have now with a little over sort of 45% of forest cover left in Malaysia, a lot of it gone to, you know, rice and agriculture or rubber, is the fact that those remaining areas then potentially become hot spots because of the accessibility by roads to poachers. So the question really is, what's happening right now is we're not seeing too much new land conversion to other land users. Forests are in the main left as forests, but it's now the network of roads and the accessibility and then the lack of enforcement or inadequate enforcement that allows people with ill intent to go into forests and set snares and poach and shoot tigers to feed into this traditional Chinese medicine market.
So when a population becomes too small, their health can suffer because of deficiencies caused by severe inbreeding. How does this affect population growth of wild tigers? And I suppose in general, if there are only 250 of them left, how are they supposed to find each other?
Yeah, this is the thing. So tigers are not social animals. They're generally solitary, yeah? But they come together, they breed, and the mother will take care of the cubs. And of course, so the way tigers work is that a male tiger will defend a territory. And in that territory it defends, it will overlap with one or two females and they'll have offspring. And if that offspring happens to be a male, when it reaches a sexual maturity, which is even less than 2 years, it has to move away from that habitat of its father. So over time, if animals want to disperse, and tigers do breed quite well, they have an offspring quite often. They're like, you know, like domestic cats. But when the animals that are intent have to disperse, but the habitat they could disperse to has been taken over by some other land use, that starts to create the problem. Okay, so they go on the fringe.
They have nowhere to go.
Nowhere to go. Contact between plantations and forests, they get shot, they get, you know, because they start killing cattle and things like that. That becomes a problem. And over time, if they get, you know, if their numbers reduce even lower and lower, then the, you know, we're talking a really small genetic pool. Then I think the ill effects of, you know, just inbreeding starts to really become a problem. I mean, really at that level, animals probably rapidly die off because, you know, you don't get animals born to be fit or healthy. They'll probably just die, you know.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Dino Sharma, Executive Director and Chief Executive Officer of WWF Malaysia. We are discussing the efforts that WWF Malaysia is making at tiger conservation, as well as what's going to happen at the inaugural Panda Ball. Up next, we find out more about identifying conservation priorities. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today is Dr. Dino Sharma, Executive Director and CEO of WWF Malaysia. We are discussing tiger conservation and the inaugural Panda Ball. So, Dr. Dino, in your line of work, how do you go about identifying conservation priorities, utilizing best practices, and implementing proven strategies to address the many challenges facing wild tigers today? Because I imagine that on the one hand, this crazy drop in numbers, and on the other hand, this crazy rise of threats, it can be kind of a difficult thing to do.
So that's not an easy one, because you know, with limited resources, you're right, one has to really prioritize. I mean, they say you got to pick your battles and pick the right ones as well. So what we do is we get our people, our scientists, our technical conservationists, and ever so often, once in a few years, we will really sit down and look at the past, look at what we've done, what was needed to be done, and look at what we have, how is our fundraising efforts going on, and then look at the issues of the day, and then we lay out a strategy. So right now, we are implementing a 2012 to 2020 strategy that contains the work we commit to do and raise resources for and hire the talent as well within the realms of freshwater conservation, forest conservation, species conservation, environmental education, policy and advocacy. And within that, again, we have to prioritize. For example, we decided to focus on saving the tiger as an iconic and an umbrella species, really, to help represent the forest that it lives in. And, you know, if we find the money, we put together a team and a series of actions and work plans. Of course, we can't do everything ourselves. It is always and invariably done with partners, the forestry department, the wildlife department, the natural resources ministry, and we go out there and do the things we do. Now, in a lot of what we do, we make a lot of assumptions. For example, if we are going on the ground to try to address the issue of tiger-human conflict, where tigers come out, eat up cattle, and people retaliate, and we need to solve the problem, we need to educate people, we make an assumption that people are willing to participate in the conservation program. Now, really, when we go on the ground, build a field house, and run a program, we have to actually bring the community towards the efforts we're trying to do. So, community buy-in and community participation in solutions are assumptions we make when we start the project. But when we sort of review the project towards the end, have we were the resources wisely spent? Did we actually achieve the goals? There's always a lot of lessons learned that we hope then translate to doing things more efficiently in similar projects, or even in a different project, trying to apply the lessons learned as well. So not easy, because what we have normally is we have more plans and strategies than money to do the work.
You mentioned human-tiger conflict, and WWF Malaysia's Tigers Alive project was initiated following the completion of your human-tiger conflict work over in Felda, Jerangau Barat in Terengganu in 2003. Could you shed more light on this project and, you know, whether or not you took away those learnings that you mentioned?
Indeed, yeah. So that was some years ago when I myself was a field biologist. I was in the field, and it all started by the Department of Wildlife and National Parks actually approaching us to say, there's this place in Terengganu at the place called Jerangau. It's a Felda scheme, and there seems to be a high proportion of tiger killings. And we'd like you to go help solve the problem. So I went to the field and I spent 2 years just talking to villagers, talking to people, and not doing any work, not doing a single bit of scientific work on the tigers. So it's really allowing the community to know who we are, why we're there, and what we're intending to do. So it's sort of the buy-in. And then after 2 years, we started the work. We started to photograph tigers. We started to run workshops with the community, share the pictures of the tigers we were taking. We started off with a local community in a Felda scheme, asking us to fence off the forest, remove all tigers and put them in zoos, or allow the tigers to eat up the cattle but compensate them. And I said, you know what, gentlemen, ladies, this is not the long-term solutions. But if you work with us, let's together try and find the solutions. I'm proud to say that having spent 4 years there, from 60 to 80 cattle being killed in a single year by tigers, after we had completed the project, we only experienced two cattle killed by tigers over a four-year period. So there was a dramatic reduction in killing of cattle by tigers. So what we did was, from that one village in Terengganu, we then went to the neighbouring state of Kelantan and went to sort of assess 40 villages in the area, and then picked a smaller complement and again applied all the lessons learned, especially in how to get communities to come on board conservation. I mean, that really was the key lesson learned. And we did it quite successfully. We did a very big program on creating materials for them in the Malay language. We had posters created and put them in all the coffee shops so people could, in between their jobs, you know, they are rubber tappers, you know, oil palm plantation workers, cattle rearers, in between their jobs. When they sit at the coffee shop having a coffee, they will stare at a poster and say, what's this all about? And then read about what they could do in their own way to help the conservation efforts.
So that reduction then in cattle killing, was it more to do with adjusting human attitudes and human behaviours with tigers and their wildlife, or was it more about trying to mitigate tiger behaviour?
So that's an interesting one, because I think it was, well, obvious to me at least when I had the first workshop and I asked them, so what do you think? And they provided me three solutions from their point of view. And when I told them that those solutions won't work in the long term, it was quite clear to me that because these were people settled into an area, these are Felda schemes, land open up for oil palm, people brought from elsewhere. So they were in some ways unlike orang asli, who have had a long tradition of living in forests and knowing how to fend for themselves, take care of themselves, understanding the behaviour of predators like tigers. So for me, that was the critical thing to, in a sense, allow myself also to learn their shortcomings and allow me to understand them. But I think the evolution of the project eventually became clear that I think people need to be given time. We need to give people time, because we as conservationists assume a lot. Sometimes we over-assume. And I think it was not about tigers. Tigers will do what tigers need to do. Tigers will feed themselves. And if you overhunt, and these people were hunting, tigers will come out, they will see cattle. The cattle have never seen tigers. They would know how to take care of themselves. They're unlike wild pigs. So tigers chance upon what we call easy targets. You know what happens? Tiger starts to learn. It's a very easy prey.
They won't do anything.
They won't do anything, right? So easy prey. So it was more about people, because people simply allowed their cattle to sleep by the roadside at the forest fringe. And when I studied all of that, I said, you know what? Tigers will keep doing what they do. We can't change tiger behavior, but we can change people's behavior. We can change their practices. We can change their husbandry practices. So one of the first things I did was I relocated all their tiger paddocks. I said, you know what? You can't have a tiger paddock by the forest edge. So we relocated paddocks. I wrote out a plan for them, when to release cattle, when to bring them back to the paddocks. No more sleeping by the road. And then I made them sign a pledge, and we stack up those pledges on all their paddocks. By 4 o'clock, all cattle must be back in the paddock, which means they have to do a bit more work because they have to cut grass, feed the cows and all that. But it became very apparent that as the months went by and they saw that the cattle had not been killed, they felt really happy. So it was about changing people's attitudes and behaviours and practices.
And you referenced orang asli earlier in comparison with people who are, I guess, not necessarily urban folk, but people who haven't had experience living out in the jungles. Does engagement with orang asli play an important role in tiger conservation?
Yes, I would say yes. In fact, a lot of our work right now is focused on the Belum Temenggor area in Perak State. And all the work that we do, whether it's about doing the research, we get orang asli to follow us so they understand how scientists, why scientists are first of all interested in saving tigers, and you know what's behind all of that. Is it just about the animal? Is it about the forest and the services forest play? So the men that follow the field teams to do the research get a first-hand knowledge about what this is all about. Then, of course, we have for the wider community community engagement programs, and we do a bit of role playing. Then we have some programs with the kids to do things that kids can understand, you know. But really, it's all about first of all us understanding how tigers interact with them, if at all, and under what circumstances. I'm quite sure over time, you know, there have also been cases of orang asli being killed, right? But maybe this go unreported, be as it may. But I think it's this issue of trying to ensure that they understand that in the modern world, in the modern times, that the forests that tigers have are no more or much reduced. The accessibility is not just to them as orang asli. In fact, people from the outside can as well not go into forests, right? So the really, at the end of it all, we try to impart a very important message that you can be really stewards, custodians of this great forest and the unique species and biodiversity like tigers, rather than succumbing to the side of working with middlemen or poachers or whatever as informants, you know. So we find that over time, more and more of the orang asli that work with us understand, willing to participate, and what I term as coming on the side of the conservation efforts rather than working with the other side.
And what can you tell me about the National Tiger Action Plan for Malaysia, 2008 to 2020?
Right. The various environmental NGOs that are working on tigers and the government got together and we helped prepare this plan. So it was a good plan. It took quite a while to prepare, but it is not just a strategy. It is one that also has a lot of actions, and it suggests the lead agencies should take part in lead those kind of actions. So, for example, you in the strategy, we find lots of parts where the core responsibility lies with the Department of Wildlife and National Parks, or sometimes at the ministry level, the Ministry of Natural Resources. And in some cases, the core responsibilities to deliver the plans lie with the various NGOs. Now, what we were asked to do, there's actually a coalition interested in saving tigers. It's called MyCat, the Malaysian Conservation Alliance for Tigers. The government actually commissioned MyCat to do an annual audit of the strategy. How are we collectively performing or failing in delivering the actions on the strategy? It is the fact, and quite sad to say, that we have not been doing really well. So many actions identified as necessary to contribute to saving tigers were not invested in financially or with human capital, and therefore not even carried out. So we were, in many cases, even going below hitting the 50% mark of delivering on the actions. So the MyCat Coalition has time and again done the assessment, prepared the report, and shared the report with the ministry. And of course, they were also very concerned about the fact of, the inaction. And so what we have right now is the government really trying to plan for resources in the 11th Malaysia Plan to invest in more efforts as identified in the Tiger Action Plan.
Malaysia is committed to an ambitious plan, here to double the tiger population to 1,000 by 2020. And this is assuming that the tiger population is 500 as opposed to 250. How do we hope to achieve this? Are we, right now, would you say that we have the right measures in place to move this forward?
So to answer the last question first, no, we don't have the right measures in place. In 2010, Putin invited all the various heads of state to go to St. Petersburg in Russia for a global tiger summit. There are probably very few instances where countries came together to discuss a singular species, right? So this is a very unique summit. And at that summit, what came out of it was all the countries, and of course there was the donor community as well, it was a huge forum, pledged, agreed, signed off on this T x 2, doubling the number of tigers by the next year of the tiger, 2022. So of course we came away. It wasn't a challenge for us because the 2008 National Tiger Action Plan actually already captured the intent, national intent, to double tiger numbers. So when we went to St. Petersburg, it was quite easy to continue that pledge. Now, pledging is one thing, action is something else. And I think I would propose that from the baseline of 500 and the recent estimate of 250, in fact, our numbers have halved, not doubled. So I think we have a bigger challenge right now. See, the challenge is really, tigers do what they do best. If you have space, you have water, and there are enough tigers, they'll breed, they'll multiply, they produce. But every event, singular events of poaching every female tiger or every male tiger reduces the overall viability of the population or their ability to add to the numbers. So if you, on the one hand, if you have some females breeding and producing, and on the other hand, you have animals being removed from the population, it's going to be it's going to be a strange equation. It is not going to help in the doubling of the numbers. So recently, the countries went to Bangladesh and did a reaffirmation of their commitment. And that commitment holds all the range countries accountable to publish midterm figures, if you like, of where are you with your numbers. And 2016, by the end of 2016, all the countries have pledged to publish their numbers. So we have a problem. Although we have an estimate of a low figure of 250 tigers, that is an extrapolation of three places where we have done the baselines and resurveyed them, and then we extrapolated. Malaysia is in a situation of being slightly embarrassed of being the only country that has not done a national survey of its tigers.
Well, it seems to me that that's as good a motivation as any to actually do it, since we can't really be left behind by everybody, surely. But if we're having trouble in the wild, some people argue that we should farm tigers, and that would be sort of an efficient way of getting those numbers back up. Where do you land on this issue?
Yeah, so WWF has always been a strong advocate of saving animals in the wild, because I think saving animals in the wild, it's about the animals themselves.
It's where they're supposed to be.
Yeah, but it's that whole process of evolution, the co-development, co-evolution, interaction between prey and predator, animals and their other species, and how that whole sort of ecosystem functioning. Some animals are top predators, they suppress populations of others, some are seed dispersers, some are nutrient cyclers, there are all kinds of roles and functions. Sometimes, really when I think about it, it is the, we're limited by our knowledge of what animals do in the whole ecosystem. And of course, then we benefit from the forest, right? It sequesters carbon, throws out oxygen, and so on and so forth. So keeping animals in the wild and ensuring they are viable in the wild is about them, but really it's about ecosystems being intact, right? And farming is a totally different ballgame altogether. Farming allows you to get the numbers because, when you farm animals, there's no predators, you can probably take care of the sick, you can do a whole range of things to keep more of them alive, so you get your numbers. But is a tiger in a farm really a tiger? Is the genetic makeup of a tiger meant to be in a farm, being fed on chickens or whatever it is? Or is it supposed to be a predator continuously evolving?
And hunting, moving,
yeah,
yes.
And facing the challenges of surviving in a forest. I mean, that really, to me, and WWF constitutes what it means to save that biodiversity.
So how effective do you feel the Wildlife Conservation Act 2010 has been since its implementation here in Malaysia?
Yeah, so the old act was a 1972 act, and we've been advocating for the longest time ever to do something about it. And the government was quite good. I mean, they had various platforms created to socialize the changes to the bill then. And then it went and got passed as a new act. And of course, we have found that because we, of course, participated in the process, that it has been a dramatic change from the old 1972 Wildlife Act. So I think the provisions of law in the Act are adequate, if I may say so. But, any policy or any Act for that matter, any bits of law, are only as good as they be actually implemented. So in this case, it is the issue of enforcement. So I think the provisions of law must be made known, of course, to people in the right places. And then we must be very serious about enforcement efforts, because I think if we show that we're serious about saving species and enforcing the law, these things, when stories are told in the media, they further inform other people to stay away from such activities. I think this is where we need to step up. We need to step up on enforcement.
And coming back specifically to the work that the WWF does, are there sufficient funds available for what you do?
No.
Perennial problem.
Perennial problem. We are constantly being challenged to find the funds. I mean, for example, we are now focusing all our tiger efforts in the Belum Temenggu area in Perak. And we've laid out a very ambitious plan because we've done the baselines there. We had an ambitious plan to do a series of activities in four segments of work, continuing the monitoring, predator and prey, looking at communities living there and all the awareness and extension work, doing joint enforcement with local authorities. But really, all that conservation effort must culminate really in ensuring that tiger numbers are, well, not stable, but increasing, right? So keeping poachers at bay. So that four-year program we've laid out is going to cost us about 8 million ringgit. I've got a 10-person tiger team, and you imagine all the effort that's going to take to actually fund that work. It's going to be 8 million over 4 years. So now we are challenged to find that money.
Which brings us quite neatly to the WWF Malaysia's inaugural Panda Ball. It's set to be held on the 13th of June. Tell us more.
Yeah, so the Panda Ball charity dinner is going to be on the 13th of June exclusively to raise money to help save tigers. All the proceeds will go 100% to saving tigers in the Belum Temenggu area and the forests around it. What we're trying to do is really requesting individuals and companies to help us do the work we've planned to do by donating to tables. So we're trying to get tables donated at a 10,000 ringgit level and at a 30,000 ringgit level. And we hope to have, you know, 50 to 70 tables for the night at the Shangri-La on 13th of June. And really, it's going to be a celebration of like-minded people coming together. There'll be some fair amount of entertainment by some local performers, Zainal Abidin, Juwita Suwito, Joanna. And what we want to do is then really to, you know, really celebrate the fact that you know, we have been successful to get people together. But what we also want to do is to try to give some of the guests a chance to join our field scientists to go into the field. So we've got a major donor trip. I believe in experiential learning. I've always been an advocate for experiential learning. I believe people need to go and see and learn and then feel enthused, excited, encouraged, given a sense of what it's all about. So we're planning a series of field trips into the Belum Temenggu area after the Panda Ball. But the Panda Ball is going to be really the big event, I think, that will raise the profile of the plight of the tiger and why we're doing what we're doing.
And in case people needed an extra perk, all donations to WWF Malaysia are tax-exempted, yes?
That's right. They're all tax-exempted. So as long as we have your details, you will receive a tax-exempt receipt.
And you mentioned that 100% of the funds are going towards tiger conservation efforts. How will you be utilising those funds? Is it in the way that you mentioned earlier, that major sort of 8 to 10 million investment?
Yes, so we have obviously four key themes. So I've got a 10-person team that will be divided into talent that's quite good at doing community extension work. So they will be developing a lot of programs, like I mentioned earlier. The orang asli that live in and around the areas need to be brought more on board the side of conservation. And of course, we've got a patrolling team that will do the enforcement and the patrolling, because we can't do enforcement. But we have created an opportunity to do joint enforcement with the partners. We've created a tool called Smart Patrolling. Smart Patrolling is a tool that you can actually use in a very systematic way and then feed into an information database that manages and informs you where are hotspots, what you need to do, what remedial actions. But it's a management tool. Then, of course, over the course of the 4 years, we will again do an intensive camera trapping across the Belum Temenggu area to then enumerate tigers again. Now, all of that, for example, let me give you an example. Each camera trap unit that we procure is about 1,500 ringgit. Right? And we will need hundreds of them to spread across the forest. And every month, they get damaged by elephants because, you know, it's just natural part. So there's some fair amount of equipment loss and stuff like that. So you know, and then, of course, you have to salary. We hire professionals. We all graduates. They have to be salaried and so on and so forth. So it's quite surprising when you think about it that, you know, if these threats weren't there, I mean, really, if the threats weren't there, we should allow tigers to survive in the forest and let Mother Nature so-called take care of her, right? Mother Nature creates the forest and provides the prey and tigers survive, they feed. And there shouldn't be a cost, really.
And
but,
yet...
but yeah, so this is a funny thing, right? So we've created the cost, right? Because we've allowed people to go and poach. We've created the roads. We've been destroying the forest and dissecting them. And tigers are, you know, don't have enough prey because of overhunting. And so we've created the problems and it becomes a cost to all of us to pay to save the tigers.
Invitations to the Panda Ball, which will be held on Saturday the 13th of June, are via donations to WWF Malaysia with a minimum donation of 10,000 ringgit for a table of 10 seats. For inquiries, you can contact Helena Yao. Email her at yhelena, that's Y-H-E-L-I-N-A, at wwf.org.my. For more information, do visit wwf.org.my/Panda Ball. Thank you very much for joining me today, Dr. Dino.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking to Dr. Dino Sharma, Executive Director and CEO of WWF Malaysia. We've been discussing their efforts towards tiger conservation, as well as what you can look forward to at the inaugural Panda Ball. I have been listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.